morning, everybody. Thanks for being with us this morning. I'm Tom Hall, and we begin today with Dr. Elizabeth Letourneau, who is the director of the Moore Center for the Prevention of Child Abuse at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Now, most of us encounter discussions of child abuse after the fact, once a crime has been committed. Too late for the child who's been victimized and who faces sometimes a lifetime of effects and consequences. Dr. Letourneau has been studying ways to prevent child abuse for more than 25 years. And on Friday, the Moore Center will host a symposium in which researchers and even self-admitted non-offending pedophiles will talk about interventions to stop these crimes before they occur. It's a tough subject, and if you're listening to our program with young children, or if you are yourself a victim of child abuse, we need to let you know that while our conversation will not at all be graphic, it will include discussion about some very troubling things. Troubling, but very important. Elizabeth Letourneau joins me today in Studio A. Good morning, and thanks for coming.
Good morning, Tom. It's a pleasure.
So you've written a piece about a year ago or so in 6 months ago in Time magazine, in which you said it's important to counter this prevailing view of child abusers as monsters. Mm-hmm. Why is that dangerous? But when we think of people like Jerry Sandusky in Pennsylvania, monster is the first word that comes to mind. I mean, these serial acts of, you know, of criminal abuse of children. But you say that actually can be dangerous. Why?
I think it is. And the Jerry Sandusky case is a great one to use as an example, because the word monster did not occur to anyone about him until after he was convicted on about 45 counts of child molestation against 10 different boys, and there's other boys out there as well. Before those convictions, he wasn't a monster. He was a regular guy. He was very well respected, well loved by many people. And there were clear, very troubling signs that got missed, I think, in part because when we think of sex offenders, we think of monsters, and we know that the people we know and love, the people in our families and in our communities who we respect and care for, are not monsters. And if they're not monsters, then they can't be child sex offenders or they can't be pedophiles. And I think that monster frame blinds us to signs that that were there and that could have caused the interruption of his behavior at a much, much earlier time.
So they blind us to the warning signs. They blind us to the indications that we might have a person here who's troubled. What are some of those warning signs?
Yeah, there's not any single piece of evidence or any single factor that indicates that someone is or is not offending against children. In the Sandusky case, we actually had eyewitness people who walked in on him sexually abusing children. That's incredibly rare. Most people are never going to have that experience, thankfully. But even that was ignored and downplayed in that case. But there's other more common signs. And, someone who spends the majority or all of his time with young children instead of with peers, who doesn't have peers in the mix. I mean, I want to be very clear. We want adult men in particular interacting with children, physically affectionate with children. Children benefit enormously from having men and women in their lives who care about them. But we all could become more capable guardians, and all could be better, I think, at interrupting these behaviors at an earlier point and preventing them altogether if we as a nation had more of a primary prevention focus, and we don't. We wait for this harm to happen. And then we come down very hard on sex offenders, which may be appropriate. We provide victims with the services that they need, which is certainly appropriate. But we don't have that third leg, which is prevention. We have that prevention leg for every other kind of childhood violence. We prevent child physical abuse. We prevent shaken baby syndrome. We effectively prevent bullying. We prevent peer-on-peer harassment. But we have not, as a nation, really undertaken the prevention of child sexual abuse, again, in part because if you think of monsters, you think of predatory, unpredictable, unpreventable beings that can't be stopped. And so that's the other reason I think that's a very dangerous frame for us to maintain.
At the symposium that you're having on Friday, one of the speakers will be a guy named Luke Malone, who's a reporter who did a piece about a year ago for This American Life, in which he introduced us to a young man named Adam. Here's a clip from his story.
Adam is now 19. Just to remind you, Adam isn't his real name, and his voice has been altered to protect his identity. But even knowing he'd be anonymous, he was uncomfortable.
I'm nervous.
Why?
Just don't think I'm a very vulgar person. it's even weird for me to say it out loud. You know, it's something I type probably, 50 times a day, just, you know, chatting with some people online. But actually saying it out loud is, you know, not very easy for me.
Do you see yourself as a pedophile?
Yes.
And have you ever acted on your attraction?
No.
Here's the first of many distinctions I wasn't clear on when I first met Adam. And it's an important one to make. Technically, you don't have to act on your desires to be a pedophile. Pedophilia marks the attraction, not the behavior. Adam doesn't want to act on his attractions.
Luke Malone from This American Life, in a story that ran in April of 2014. So, Elizabeth Letourneau, is Adam unusual, a young man who has these attractions but doesn't act on them?
We certainly know that there are many people like Adam. I count Luke as a friend and Adam as a consultant, actually, on some of our work.
And I should mention that Adam will be one of the people appearing by audio at this conference.
We're having a panel of young men who have self-identified as being sexually attracted to children but are committed to not offending against children. Adam may be one of those young men. He hasn't fully committed yet, but the other two have, and I think that's going to be a very important part of our symposium for demonstrating to the public that there are, in fact, people who are born with an attraction to children, and the way that we are born with an attraction to male or female, there also seems to be an age attraction that we're born with. The brain science is building around that. And they don't want that attraction, and they understand the harmfulness of it, and they don't want to act on it. But right now, there's no place for them to receive any kind of help, again, because we really put all of our eggs in the basket of after the fact, making the best of a bad situation interventions instead of preventative interventions.
Because the mental health community is in a tough spot here, because Adam, for example, in Luke's story, we heard that Adam went to a psychologist and told this person about this attraction, and the psychologist felt compelled to report this. I mean, that there's a mandatory reporting law. There are a lot of people who thought that had there been more stringent mandatory reporting laws in Pennsylvania, that Sandusky wouldn't have gotten away with what he did for as long as he did. What's a mental health professional to do when confronted with this information from somebody?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that we all need to do, and we all need to be aware of mandatory reporting laws. Maryland's law is very broad. Every adult is a mandatory reporter. If you suspect child sexual abuse, you are to contact Child Protective Services, Department of Social Services, and they'll launch an investigation. And I think mandatory reporting laws are on par, very good. There's been a decline in child sexual abuse dating since 1990. Those laws came into effect in the late 80s and early 90s, and I'm certain that they are part of the reason we have declining rates of child sexual abuse and we have increasing rates of reporting. But many people don't report either because they don't know the law or because they don't want to, and there are instances that don't need to be reported. We need to be able to give help to individuals who haven't started offending, and there's no reporting law around someone who hasn't started offending and providing them services. But a lot of mental health professionals really just don't know how to deal with this issue, again, because we haven't put resources into the design and development and evaluation, importantly, the rigorous evaluation of prevention programs. So it's not like a mental health therapist can go get trained up on what to do with someone like Adam. And so that's part of what our center is doing, is launching several primary prevention interventions that we hope to evaluate and to disseminate if they prove to be effective.
I'm 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Elizabeth Letourneau is my guest. She's the director of the Moore Center for the Prevention of Child Abuse at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. They're holding a symposium on the subject of preventing child abuse this Friday. The research that you're doing, one of the things that distinguishes it is that there's very little research on people who are not yet offenders. Most of the research is on people who've been convicted of a crime. They've been caught. What are you learning from people like Adam who have yet to act on their attraction? And when you talk to them, are you trying to change the attraction, or are you just trying to make sure that the behavior doesn't harm children?
One of our prevention programs that we're working on developing right now would target teens who are sexually attracted to young children. That's a very small segment of the population. Best estimates, which are not very good, but the best estimates are maybe between 1 and 3% of sexually mature males are attracted to prepubescent children, to young children. And for many of them, it's likely that that attraction is not changeable. As I said, you know, we are born with a gender attraction, particularly for men. That's a very stable attraction. You either like women or you like men. And there's some people that are in between, absolutely. But for the most part, that stays pretty stable once you hit adolescence. And it may well be this way with this age attraction to young children. So the intervention that we are designing, and we're going to talk with people like Adam, who live with sexual attraction to children, but are success stories. They are living in their communities without offending against children, and they're succeeding in their jobs and their personal lives, and try to figure out for them what would have helped them when they were adolescents, what would have made their lives easier to navigate, what strategies that they used to not sexually abuse children, to not act out on their attractions. And what strategies did they use to also feel good about themselves and recognize that they are not their attraction, but that they have worth beyond that?
Well, thanks for coming in and talking to us about a very difficult subject, and good luck on the symposium on Friday.
Thank you,
Appreciate
Tom.
It. Dr. Elizabeth Letourneau, she's the director of the Moore Center for the Prevention of Child Abuse at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The center's annual symposium takes place Friday from 9 to 4 at Bloomberg. It's in Sheldon Hall on Wolf Street. The symposium is free and open to the public, and they'd like you to register, so we'll have a link for you to do that on our website. We'll also have a link to a live stream of the conference. Come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. After the news, Sheila speaks with Dr. Mario Livia from the Hubble Space Telescope Science Institute. It's Maryland Morning. Stay with us.